Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 21st, 2006. Today's session is entitled, Is Wealth Demoralizing? Presented by John Wallace. Number is WA-JO-2006-05. Let's listen in.
Wallace, some of you are new, some of you have been here all week. I've been talking about some stuff since Monday about the process of economic development and how we understand what developments happen. And I want to talk about some stuff today. Ron isn't here. Ron said he'd come, but he's not here because I want to confess to him this morning. A couple things. So he's been here 4 years. I've been here. I came here 39 years ago. No, yeah, 1967 for the first time. And so I want to talk about that a little bit because it relates to some of the stuff that I want to talk about today. But I wanted, you know, I'm just reading what Ron tells me to read now. So I came to the Bible study and I went up and read Colossians. It's short, you know, you can read it pretty quick. So some of the things that we read this morning too, about the fullness of life in Christ. See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the universe, and not according to Christ. Now, you know, I have a PhD. I'm a doctor of philosophy. I do not want to take you in with philosophy and empty deceit. I'm worried about that. For in him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily, and you have come to the fullness in him who is the head of every ruler and authority.
Good idea.
Okay. Here comes one of my punchlines, and what got me thinking about this when Ron had the woman over here read it, and the translation I have is slightly different. Therefore, do not let anyone condemn you in matters of food and drink, or of observing festivals, new moons, or Sabbaths. These are only a shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Do not let anyone disqualify you, insisting on self-abasement and worship of angels, dwelling on visions puffed up without cause by a human way of thinking. I think in the other translation it was puffed up by false humility. Do not let anyone shame you with false humility. Chapter 2, this is verse 16 to what I'm going to read will be 23. And not holding fast to the head, from whom the whole body, nourished and held together by its ligaments and sinews, grows with a growth that is from God. Whole body. If with Christ you died to the elemental spirit of the universe, why do you live as if you still belong to the world? Why do you submit to regulations? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, scrape your plates. All these regulations refer to things that perish with use. They are simply human commands and teachings. These have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-imposed piety, humility, and severe treatment of the body, but they are of no value in checking self-indulgence. So, Ron, are you here?
No.
So one of the things that he had today in the Bible study, and I put it back up. I promised Carl I wasn't going to write on anything, and I didn't. I just wrote what was erased. It was usually here. Pilgrimage of place. He had, you know, the politics of place and the poetry of place, right? So I have a thing with the place here, because I came to Holden when I was 15 years old. And the last time I was here, I was 26 years old, okay? And, you know, so a big part of who I am is at Holden, and so I kind of have this pilgrimage. I hadn't been here for a long time. When Paul and Carol and Tom said, we'd like you to come, we'd like you to help, and I wrote a letter and I said, hey, whatever you need, you know, I'll come. But I have this guilt in my life, okay, that I was going to confess to Ron. But I'll confess it to you guys, and you can then tell him about it, which is that, you know, I don't visit the sick and the homeless, and I don't feed the hungry. Okay? I did that, and I've done that. Okay? And I want to talk about what I'm doing, you know, because I'm proud of what I'm doing. Okay? And figuring out things. But I had to make choices. You know, I live in a world of sin. I can't do all the stuff I'm supposed to do. Okay? Now, this is not a confession. Next week, I'm not even going to talk about this, but I'm going to show this. This is my World Bank ID card. Okay? I'm a consultant at the World Bank. I go down there. I even have, you know, so I have my little thing that's got a World Bank logo on it. When I go down there, I put it on my pocket. And when I go into the building, because it's big security, because people threaten to blow the place up, there's Jersey walls there, and I go like this, and I run it over the scanner, and the guard says, you can come through. Okay? Now, I knew if I came up here on Monday and said, hey, I'm from the World Bank, there's a bunch of people around here who would stop listening to me. Right? And I'm not from the World Bank like I'm bringing you the mission, the truth. I'm not, Wolfowitz didn't commission me to come to Holden Village and bring you the truth. Okay? But you walk into the World Bank, the big building, it's on I Street in Washington, D.C. It's right off Pennsylvania Avenue, actually, 1818. And it says, help the poor. And that's what's right there on the wall. That's what we're here to do. Okay? What's it doing? It's a bank. It's a lot of rich people there. There's a lot of really rich people there. Okay, there's a lot of really poor people there. They're really concerned about it. It's kind of funny. It's kind of like Holden Village in a bank. All the signs up there don't say, let's go make capitalism work. They say, let's help the poor. You know, let's help women in Nigeria. Let's do things like that. That's what they're, you know, and so I have this kind of disconnect. When I know if I say I'm from the World Bank and I'm a CEO, you know, I'm as we said yesterday, evil. You know, I don't know. Children, which is place. I owe Holden some. You know, I owe Paul and Carol and Tom some.
I'm going to cry too because I owe my grandmother some.
And Carol Hinderly. So how do you do that? You know, how do you repay the gifts? Hey, Ron, you're here. I'm confessing. I read Colossians. You know, how do you do that? You don't. You can't. It's a gift. You don't repay a gift. It's not a gift. It's something you can't. You know, how do you do it? How do you say this? How do we figure out how to help the poor? You know? How do we do it without making it an issue of piety? It fries my ass when people say, as they've done in the village, that shouldn't we think about the danger of raising incomes in developing countries because it might hurt the community these people live in, or it might hurt their moral and ethical development. And I think, you gotta be kidding me. You live in the United States and you're telling me that people in Latin America or people in Africa who live on nothing should not be given the hope because it might affect their moral and ethical development and you know what's right for them? It pisses me off. I got things I'm guilty about, Ron.
Hey, I can hear it. I'll have a solution after this, we'll see.
Okay? I don't know, and I don't know that what I'm doing is right. I'm a beggar. I ask God for things. I ask Him to give me understanding. I ask Him to help me see things. And Ellen, we call it clear channel. Sometimes I'm sitting there and I'm gone. Stuff's coming in from somewhere. God, I hope it's the Holy Spirit. I have to have faith that it's the Holy Spirit. I don't know why I figured some of this stuff out. It's a gift. I said on Monday that I thought if I could get the World Bank to do something, or if I could get China, if I could somehow come up with an idea that raised income in China by 0.5%, it would eradicate more poverty than anything I could do in my life on an individual basis. Does that justify me not feeding the hungry and visiting the men in prison? And no, I don't think so, but that's kind of the way I justify it. Sometimes I'm guilty. You know, I'm guilty. I think it's important for us to understand both chairs. I don't think we can be a Christian. And God comes to this chair. He comes to John the person and forgives me and saves me regardless of what's going on over here. But damn it, if I want to help the poor and hungry, I got to understand these chairs. Because if I don't understand how the world works, I cannot help these people in the most effective way. I cannot use my talents and my gifts most effectively. I can say, for me, I'm going to help the poor, and I'm going to make this guy feel good about it. And I'm going to have trouble because there's too many things to do, and I'm going to leave a bunch of things undone. You know, but we got to understand this. Because in the last 500 years of human history, the world has been changed. Okay? We live in a society that did not ever exist. Okay? There are no parallels to the world that we live in before 1500. There aren't. There are no open access societies. There are only Ron, Don, and John societies. There are only natural states. We live in a violent society. There's 14,927 murders last year. How many of those were for money? Well, but Rod's talking about people dying. Most people in America die of old age or sickness. They're not murdered. How many people are dying in the Sudan this year? Or Rwanda? Or Cambodia. Okay? They're not dying of old age. They're killing each other with shovels in Rwanda. Right? Why? I don't know. I do know, actually. I understand it. Because their natural state broke down. Their Ron John thing went to pieces. And when it goes to pieces, they do not become developed. They become anarchic. And in that kind of society, people die. It's the fear of that, right? That drives the Ron, Don, John bargain, the natural state bargain. I'm sorry, I'm not going to explain it again this morning if you haven't been here all week. I'm going to skip over quickly. People in America aren't murdered too much for money. They're mostly murdered by their friends and their family and the people they know. The guy who we've been hearing about all week, he was outside of a club. It wasn't about money. He said something wrong. He waved his hand the wrong way. Somebody was pissed off and they shot him. Ellen and I have this discussion. Ellen doesn't get what men are about. I say, no, you don't. You're right. I know I don't understand what women are about. What? And I know that Ellen doesn't understand that when you're a man, you understand that if you do the wrong thing, you can begin a fight. And it's not something you can get away from. Because if you're in a fight, you're in a fight even if you didn't want to be in a fight. Right? We live in a world of potentially violence. And our world is a lot less violent than most places. Unfortunately, in America, we haven't gotten rid of guns, or we'd be a whole lot less violent and a whole lot less mortal about it, because European countries have way lower mortality rates from violence than we do. Okay? But we live in a society that every once in a while goes bananas, World War I, World War II, lots of people die. But on a daily basis, it's not like most of the rest of the world, and it's not like most of the rest of human history. And so we don't do a lot of things to protect ourselves, because we live in a world in which we have security. And as a result, we have the freedom to think about, boy, you know, haven't my morals and ethical development been adversely affected by commercialism? Yeah, what about my morals and ethical development when I have to be ready to fight somebody to stay alive? That's a gift from our society. Okay? It's a gift I'd like to give to everybody. I'd like all the societies in the world to be developed, and I don't care if they have Big Macs. And I don't care if they die early from heart attacks. Okay? I don't care. What's wealth? Who was here? Is the woman here last night who was asking me to talk about wealth? I didn't talk about it because we were talking too much about now instead of the history. You know how an economist defines wealth? Choices. Choices. The more choices you have, the wealthier you have. What's Verlon complaining about? Choices. He sees me as having choices that he doesn't, and I'm wealthier. I can do things he can't do, he thinks. Maybe I can, maybe I can't. Okay. Wealth is choice. The more choices we have, the wealthier we are, because we can choose between all these different alternatives. I don't want to get into too much economics. I'm talking to the Lund brothers about this all week long, about choices and how we make them. Wealth is choices. When you have kids, what do you want to give them? Alternatives. You want to give them choices. You want to let them, you want to enable them to make good choices. And then you cry when they make a choice that you cannot understand. Okay? Because of the alternatives, you have a preferred one, and almost always they don't pick it. In fact, you should be worried if they did, because they did it for you. not for them. They're going to pay. We're going to pay. We're going to be guilty about that down the road. So I want to know how my pilgrimage to Holden is to come back and say, how do we increase choices? And that's what wealth is about, and that's why those 25 rich countries may or may not be immoral. I'm going to talk about that a little bit too, if I don't confess for the next 30 minutes. How is it that we shape societies? How do we understand what's going on with these chairs, these organizations, these structures? How do we understand how societies create seats that enable people to have freedom, that enable people to make more choices, that enable competition, not competition in the, what is it, mutually exclusive gain accomplishment way, one winner and a bunch of losers, but how do they get to compete? I talked yesterday about how America decided, figured out completely inadvertently how to get open entry into corporations because they were trying to solve a way to save democracy. They said, let's have economic competition so we can protect political competition. That's the way the Americans figured it out. France and Britain figured it out in a different kind of way. They actually had more economic competition, not much politics, and they increased their political competition to get their economics. When we talked about the Ron John world, we talked about a natural state. We talked about a system in which the powerful create economic privileges for themselves because those economic privileges create interests which lead them to choose not to be violent. Okay, as a way of organizing society, I said that is a system in which economics serves the end of politics. Those two things are together. We need to understand how in our world economic and political systems are mutually reinforcing, right? Ask George Bush what he'll say is the government ought to get out of the economy altogether. They ought to be completely separate. Good luck, and God bless, because if it really happens, we're going to lose our economy. Right? Because our economy, as Steve Ball was telling us, depends on regulation. It depends on having a strong government that says, here's the rules by which you compete. You know, if I pull out a gun to compete for resources, you know, maybe I'll get away from it. Yeah, you know, maybe Ron will be there the next day with a poll, right? But I'm probably going to end up in jail. I don't need the law. Law's not for me. I'm a Christian. I can't kill anybody. Man, I want those laws, right? I don't know. You're a Christian. I don't know if you're going to get so pissed off that you stop being a Christian for 5 minutes. Right? I want these laws. I want these things. Okay? Now, the Western political philosophy goes back to the Greeks. And it's, you know, in several times in our history, it's been rediscovered. It's been lost and refound. You know, part of our church history is the rediscovery of Greek philosophy. And it was lost. They didn't have the books. They didn't know what's going on. It comes back. And they talk about it. And as we talked a little bit about yesterday, the essence of Western political philosophy is the concept of balance. Okay? In a Don, John, Ron world in which the powerful have to be set against one another, what maintains the social order is the balance of interests. Okay? So if you read Machiavelli, I really like Machiavelli. Machiavelli is a pretty neat guy. What's the famous book? The Prince. What's the good book? Anybody know?
The Devil. No.
No. The good book, The Prince, is all about how, if you're running a place, how you should act so you don't get killed. Right? How smart you should be at setting up against interests against one another and playing guys. And should you be mean or should you be nice? Well, that turns out you should be both at the right time. Mean when you need to be, nice when you need to be. It's better to be mean. You know, if you got to choose one or the other all the time, be mean. The good book is discourse called Discourses on Livy. It's called Discourses on the First 10 Chapters of Livy. Livy was a Roman historian. He lived in the time of Augustus at the formation of the empire and the end of the republic. And Livy wrote 160 books on the history of Rome, of which about 35 survive. The first 10 survive. And the first 10 books of Livy talk about how the Roman Republic managed to produce this enormous empire. That one of my favorite classical historians is a man named Polybius. Polybius was a Greek who lived in 200 BC. His father was a mayor, was the leader in a city that the Romans took over, and they took all the younger sons to Rome as hostages, right? So their fathers would behave, you know, not piss the Romans off. Yeah, I'm sorry to talk like, I keep wanting to talk like Ron. And not piss them off, you know, big neck knees. And he would have said more than that. And so Polybius lives in the house of Scipio, who becomes Scipio Africanus, the man who's the family that's going to conquer Carthage. Okay? And Polybius writes about, he opens his book with, we got to figure out how this little city managed in 52 years to conquer the known world. And he writes that in 200 BC when the Republic is at its height. And Livy comes along when the Republic is going to be turned into an empire. It's going to lose its balance of parts. And he says, how did the Republic go? What's happening? And Machiavelli reads Livy, and Discourses on Livy is 4 or 5 times thicker than The Prince, which is a little slender volume. And it's an exegesis. It's a Bible study on Livy. It's what are the stories that Livy tells? Okay. And Machiavelli in Discourse on Livy says, you know, there's two groups in Rome. There's the Senate, and there's the mob. Right? The people, the mob. The populace, the plebes. There's lots of names for them. And constitutionally, they're represented in an assembly, but the assembly is not really like the democratic body. It's a really weird thing. It's kind of fun to read about because they have these crazy voting rules. They vote by tribes. Talk about racism. Yeah. But what Machiavelli says is what happens in when you read Roman history, and it is a great opening. He says, you know, all the houses in, he lived in Florence, all the houses in Florence have Roman statues in the entryways. And he says, you know, we got to get rid of these statues. I mean, they're pretty, they're nice to have, but the problem is we shouldn't be worshiping them. You know, we shouldn't be trying to live like Romans. We shouldn't be trying to recapture the glory of Rome. We should be learning from their lessons to make a better world. That's kind of what the Renaissance is about. It's not just studying the old things. It's not Gratian and the Decretists and the canon lawyers who are studying the Roman law to figure out how to order their society. Machiavelli is saying, we should be reading this history so that we can make our society better. It's not surprising that, you know, there's Luther and Machiavelli at the same time. And people beginning to think about how do we learn from our history, how do we learn from this chair, about how to organize our societies. And what Machiavelli says is you look at Rome, and when you read Livy, all the great scenes are these conflicts between the people and the aristocracy. I mean, there's one, so what are the people, the lever they have? If they're pissed off at the aristocrats, they don't show up for the yearly war. They won't show up for the army. And all the aristocrats are officers, and they're defined by how many weapons they bring, and there's all these requirements and stuff. And so when there's a conflict between the Senate that the aristocrats are represented in, and by birth, right, it's kind of funny in Rome because what makes you a patrician is, it's kind of an endogenous thing. You can't take the auspices, you can't perform religious rites if you're not a patrician. So the plebes can't go to war because they don't know whether they're going to win or lose unless there's a patrician around. They're kind of locked in this, the people can't get rid of the aristocrats, and the aristocrats can't get rid of the people. And all the great scenes are when they get really mad at each other. You know what's mostly over? Land. The Romans conquer land, and who's going to get it? Are the aristocrats going to get to expand their land holdings, or is the Roman Republic going to distribute it among the people? They call them agrarian laws, but agrarian laws are about the ownership of land. Some things haven't changed, right? Verlon and Peter are still pissed off about land. Same problem. And Machiavelli says the genius of Rome is not, I'll say this the right way, that people read Roman history and say, all these times when stuff is all chaotic, that's when it's really bad. Let's discover how Rome is ordered. And Machiavelli says, you don't understand if that's the way you read the history. Because it's in the times when it's chaotic and when these two forces are fighting one another that the vitality of Rome is being exhibited. The fact that the people are weighed against in a balance against the aristocracy. That's what makes Rome vital and alive. And the fact that this adjusts and changes is what makes the Roman Republic work. That's Machiavelli's political science. I'm not sure political science has gotten too far past that.
The
I mean, one of my co-authors is a political scientist, and I have several friends who are political scientists. They're really great guys. They're very smart and stuff, but they don't know. They can't tell me. They can't answer my questions about why the political system works. They can't tell me why America works. You know, they're studying Congress and voting laws and stuff like that. I said, tell me why it works. Because they think the economy doesn't matter. They're like the idiots who think that the economy, there's no politics in economics, and the more politics we get out of it, the better the economy will work. You know, they don't think, well, look around the world. All the developed economies have developed polities. So Machiavelli says it's this balance that's working. And now, what upsets the balance? Well, here Machiavelli has a problem. He says it's corruption. And he says, you know, things get good for a while and people get rich. And they get rich, you know, the guys who work hard, you know, they give their money to their kids and their kids haven't worked hard and they start partying, they start doing drugs, you know. They drink beer, they marry guys that drive beer trucks just for the beer. You know, they're corrupted. They have no morals, they have no ethics, and this spreads through the society, and inevitably what happens? Whole thing collapses. Right? So there's these cycles of virtue and corruption. You can't read this stuff without seeing the word corruption. There's a famous, John Murren is a historian at Princeton who writes about early 19th century America, that Jefferson and Madison in the bank controversy in 1790, as we talked about yesterday, when they declared that Washington and Hamilton were corrupt, bequeathed to America a language of corruption. That we cannot talk about our politics without talking about corruption. You know, we can say competition is the discourse of America, it's the language, and Jeff has talked about that this week. We had a forum about it on Monday night. But in fact, our discourse about politics is largely about corruption. You're corrupt. The other guy is always the corrupt one. Right? So we talk about corrupt corporations. We talk about bad men. And we go meet them and they're nice. They're guys like Steve Ball. They're not evil. We watch movies in which they're evil. And yeah, some of these guys really are bad. There's some politicians that scare me to death. But we need a discourse. We need words, right? Remember what I said? They left. Can't remember the name. The guy talked about China 2 days ago. What's going on in China? I talked about culture.
Denny,
okay. Talked about gravity and how we learn words and what they mean, right? We can't. How much corn is grown in the United States every year? Who knows, right? Figure it out. Did somebody count it? Can you imagine? Some of you from Iowa, Illinois, can you imagine how much time it would take to count the corn in one field? You couldn't do it. But I mean, by the time you got to the end of the field, the growing season would be over and they'd be plowing it under. And then there's, you know, millions of acres. Well, you don't do that, right? We have a way of counting. I could talk to you about it. Somebody was asking me about how we count income. I could talk to you about that, because how do you count up everybody's income? You can't do it, right? So we have a construct. We have a language of ways. I could explain to you how we do it, because actually I do, you know, part of my job is doing that a little bit. I know that people really do it for a full-time job. But they don't not know. But they don't know for sure. We need words to talk about our society, because we can't experience it all. You only experience it in a little neighborhood. Right? Ron comes up here and says, I'm talking about Salishan. Now, I want to talk about some other stuff, but my authority is going to come from the fact that it happens in my world. Right? That's right. I hear that. I feel that. I'm confessing that. You know? My world is in books. I can't go talk to Machiavelli, figure out what he did. I can't go back to 19th century America. We got to have concepts to do that. And the concepts we have form what we see. If we see corporations as evil, we're going to see corporations as evil. We're going to see our corporation as not a corporation. We're going to see our corporation as a community, as an organization,
So whatever, but we're not going to put the bad words on it, even though the laws of the state of Washington and the United States of America and Chelan County dramatically affect this place, and they help hold this place together, right? We're not going to see that. We're going to see the Forest Service as a pain in the butt. We're going to see the Chelan County School District as a thorn in our side. You know, I got over here and I started saying it, didn't I?
Yeah.
You know, I got over here the person chair and started getting pissed off about the corporate chair.
Are you schizophrenic?
I don't know. So I got some more to say, but I'm going to shut up for a minute. Because you know what happens? I came within a hair's breadth of being a preacher.
We could tell.
It didn't happen. Who was the president of Luther Seminary who used to come up here?
Yeah,
Rogers. Ral Rogers. Now, he and I we were drinking beer at my grandmother's house once. And I was thinking about going, you know, getting a, what was it? What'd you get for seminary deferment? What was the number?
Oh, you mean for the draft?
Yeah, I was
4D.
4D. Yeah, 4D. 4F was I got flat feet. 4D is I was going to go to seminary. You know, I was thinking about it. I really didn't want to go. You know, I talked to Al Rogers about it. I was thinking about going to seminary. I was thinking about going to seminary for other reasons, and I decided not to because I said, well, you know, let's get down to brass tacks. Let's see whether I want to go to prison or not. Do I really hold these beliefs?
Yeah.
Carol Hinderly, Paul had to rewrite my letter for conscientious objector because his dad said, if the Vietnamese were coming up the beaches of Orange County, John would be the first guy out there with a gun. Okay, why am I telling you the stories? I don't know. I'm getting off the track.
I ain't around too much.
I'm over there in the person chair. I don't know. What was I talking about? Oh, I was going to be quiet. That's it. That's it. See, I was going to be a preacher. But Al Rogner said, yeah, think about it. Don't be a preacher because you want to get out of the draft. Actually, I was supposed to be an economist. Yeah, I was called to do this stuff, I think. Maybe not.
That's your goal.
But I think I was. So I'm going to shut up unless you guys don't want to talk. Yeah. You want me to talk about it?
Because I have a lot of interesting thoughts on the topic, and I feel like when you mentioned it previously this week, it was very unnuanced, and I'd be curious to hear some more explanation of your understanding.
Yeah, okay, that's good. That's what I should talk about. I should deliver on my promise, shouldn't I?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We know that a bunch of the world is undeveloped. There are different words for it. You know, first world, third world. There's not any second world anymore. What was the second world?
Communist.
The communists, they're all gone. I mean, they're still there. Mm-hmm. There's still a communist party in China, so China might be second world, but the other places have become something. They've mostly dropped into the third world. A few of them are making it. Most of them aren't. Okay. So there's first and third world, or there's developed and developing, and there's rich and poor. Now, I almost thought about reading from the Beatitudes instead of from Colossians today. You know, the meek shall inherit the earth. You know, the poor, what will the poor do? Will they be rich? What? Now, there are questions about why those guys are poor. What's the is there a difference in outcomes between poor countries? Are they all the same poor?
No.
They're really different. Okay. Tolstoy says, you know, all happy families are alike, and all unhappy families have their own reasons for being unhappy. Poor countries are not the same. Okay, and rich countries are not the same. And that poses a real problem for us. We know that almost all the rich countries have a democratic political system. In some sense, they have a competitive political system. What's happened in Taiwan and in South Korea? They weren't democratic countries 50 years ago. They're having elections, right? I mean, the dictators are saying, oh, hey, you know, we really want economic development, and we're beginning to realize if we want to do this, then we got to have political competition. Because if I want Intel to come in and invest $1 billion, I better credibly promise to Intel I'm not going to steal that plant when it gets here. How do I do that? Well, you know, my word as the dictator, it's not worth the paper it's written on, right? Because his power comes out of the end of a gun. to point the gun at Intel? No, the Intel sector. Sorry, we're out of here. But very few places have made that. Does democracy cause economic development? This is a causal question. This is a therefore. Because they're democratic, they're developed? No, turns out it doesn't work. You can introduce democracy into a country, and it doesn't produce economic development or political development. What happens to most democracies in poor countries?
Become dictatorships.
Right, and they become dictatorships. Mexico's had elections for the entire 20th century. How many parties won the elections until just recently?
One.
The PRI, the revolutionary, if somebody knows Spanish can say it, right? Somebody says, why is it PRI if it's revolutionary party? I said, I don't know. It's the revolutionary institutional revolutionary party. There's a big oxymoron. The institutionalized revolution. Right? What's happening in Mexico today? Have they figured the vote count out yet?
No.
Now they're trying to figure out whether they're going to have a competitive election, and the loser is threatening to do what? Go to the streets. Not to the Supreme Court. I don't trust those guys. Right. Colombia. Colombia had, you know, all the Latin American countries, they adopted something like the American Constitution. You know, they had the form there. And what happened? They were violent. They had revolutions and they had continuous warfare. Colombia finally made a deal in 1950 where the two major parties agreed to alternate control of the government every 4 years. That's how they resolved it, because they couldn't. So they have elections in Colombia, but the outcome is decided. Now, for those two parties to make it work, it means nobody else can have a political party, because we put a third one in here, it's going to destabilize the whole thing. Okay, so Colombia has real problems. Colombia's trying to grow. Are we helping in Colombia? It's really hard to say. You know, we're going down there and say, well, we would like you to put a bunch of your people in jail, and here's some weapons to do it with, because they'll sell drugs to us. You know. We'd like you to solve our drug problem. Doesn't solve it. Okay. That those countries in Africa have so little social structure that they break down and start killing each other. We gave them the weapons. You know, after World War II was over, when we got one in worlds one and two, the Americans and the Soviets went to the third world and said, we'd like you to be on our side. Here's some tanks and bazookas and missiles. And of course, they took them and said, hey, let's fight each other. How do we get in control? If we get in control, we can get some money from the United States or whatever. And it's easy to do that and blame the United States, but in fact, it's not the United States. It's them.
But if we didn't give them weapons, they'd be using spears and rocks.
No kidding.
So we just make it easier for them to slaughter each other. So that's not our fault.
Look, I got lots of guilt today. We want to confess together some guilt? Sure. I don't have a problem with that. Somebody said the other day about that the boycotts in the United States caused the fall of the South African regime. Don't ever say that. Don't ever say because you didn't buy stock in Coca-Cola that you freed apartheid. Don't believe you're so powerful. Who freed themselves? South Africans freed themselves. We helped, right? Who freed America from Britain, from tyranny and slavery? We did, right? Who's gonna keep America free? We are. Are we gonna make anybody else free? No. Are we gonna go with guns and make somebody, you know? What does Iraq need? Here we go. What does Iraq really need now? They need a Ron, John, Don setup. Are we helping there? No, because we're not. We are Ron. John and Don are gone, right? And we don't want to deal with anybody who might be a warlord thug in Iraq who could possibly bring stability, because that's not going to promote democracy, right? When we go to places like, I'm getting ready to stand up. When we go to places that are failed natural states, okay, when we go to places where they're right on the edge of anarchy, and in this century, in the last 20 years, we've seen societies break down. When you live in one of those societies, what you want is tyranny, okay? What you want is for the strong guys to get together and agree to stop fighting. Because even if they take everything from everybody else will be better because they won't be dead. They won't be living in fear. Now, does the World Bank want to hear that? No. Do you want to hear that? No. Do I want to get up and say that? You know, it's really tough to swallow. But what I've been saying this week implies that in places that are really, really screwed up, that democracy is not an answer, that competition is not an answer, that limited access and rent creation is the way humans solve those problems, that's a tough thing for us to buy. Because we want to export democracy. If we go to a natural state that's not doing very well and we say we want you to become competitive because competition is what makes our system work, what will that do to their system? It'll destabilize it. Right? If Ron and John and Don control everything and it's their control of everything that keeps them from fighting and we want to get competition in, right? So we say you must have competition, and that... I'm going to talk like a communist for a minute, that erodes the rents, that erodes the profits, let's use that word, that Ron, Don, and John get from being in control. Ron, Don, and John lose their incentives to not fight. They go right at it. So we go in with prescriptions that probably don't work, but the right prescription doesn't sound good to us. Maybe if it's the right one, I don't know, I'm going on faith here that I figured some of this out. So we should allow them to have what appears to be an unjust, repressive system. Because it keeps them from killing each other. Do we say that? I don't know.
Seems quite simplified to lean it all on economics and competition. I mean, I feel like...
I didn't lean it all on economics and competition.
Yeah.
Did I?
But I feel like when you said in Sudan they're killing each other because of limited... because they don't have open opportunities. And that's definitely a very important part of it. But I feel like there's a lot more complex historical, cultural dynamics that are going on there.
Yeah.
And so when we say it's...
Well, you want me over here.
Access, then it seems too simple, too much simplified.
Yeah, it is. It has to be. I don't know what the hell is going on in the whole village. I've been here 28 years. I've been trying to figure it out this week, and I'm not. I'm getting some pieces figured out, but not all of them. Okay, I don't know why you guys in the kitchen don't smile. I can't figure it out. I used to work in the kitchen with Paul. We smiled all, we'd laugh and make fun of ourselves, but I can't, you know, I don't get it. And clearly to do that, I got to know not only this chair, I got to know all these chairs. Mm-hmm. You're right, right? If we want to do this, we want to understand a place, we got to understand all the people. If I want to understand what's going on in Ron's neighborhood, I got to go to Ron's neighborhood. And I got to talk to this guy and that guy, okay? And history is really complex. I know. Okay. But I want to see something. Okay? I want to see something that makes sense so I can begin to understand more. So I agree with you. I'm being too simple. I'm trying to be persuasively simple. I'm trying to be simple in a way that opens up a window. Rather than says, oh, it's just this. I'm not trying to say that. But I'm trying to say it is. I'm trying not to say, and I can't do this because I'm an economist. I speak like an economist. I'm trying to say this is politics, economics, and it's religion, and it's education, all wrapped into one because the Ron, Don, John system is not a system of politics. It's a system of everything. And that we need to see how those systems fit. Yeah, you had your hand up? And then over here?
Could you speak to the really popular explanations of why things are so difficult is colonialism and the unnatural borders, lumping tribes and things like that.
Yeah, these guys were really rich
right.
Until 1500.
Well, my question is, there was at some point in Europe, and Europe used to be a patchwork, a little
tiny. Yeah. Yeah.
So at some point, it was worth it for people to put aside being a Lombard or a Breton and become French.
They killed each other over that for centuries.
But the point is that it seems like one of the solutions, it seems like the solution that comes to mind in these countries, especially where there's two strong ethnicities, is that they're going to break apart. I mean, one solution for Iraq would be to have three states.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, do you have any idea about, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Or
okay, we got it. What metric do we want to use? No, part of what I'm doing here is saying there's two social systems, right? There's a natural state system that works and provides social order through
through the creation of rents, through limited access, by giving privileges to a small group. Okay? And that's that is a way to organize society. And mostly when we read political theory and we think about corporations as bad, we're thinking about those guys, because in that world, a corporation is a privilege granted to a few people. Or are we talking about a world of competition? In a world of competition, bigger is better. Right? In our world, the fact that North Dakota cannot prevent people from New York moving there and starting a business is a really, really good thing. It makes our system more competitive and supports a social order. In a natural state, that kind of competition is destabilizing. Right? That's why the dynamic of the... We can't say it's the same rules in the two societies because they operate under different rules. And so if... I think Iraq is such a basket case that we ought to give up trying to promote democracy. And we ought to get the hell out of there and let them figure out a solution. It will not be one that we like. We will not like it. It will not look like the United States. It won't. It can't. Okay? There's no order there. There's no British Whig theory to build a revolution on. There's no Europe that's figured out these pieces. Okay. Europe has all these chairs lying around. It's not just pieces of paper, it's what people believe. We believe that we're free. We are. But it's not a state of nature, folks. It's a state of our society. It's a gift that we give to each other. And if we don't have that freedom, and we don't have that chair, we can't. The paper doesn't do it. The guns don't do it. How do we get a society to do it? So I don't know. It depends, you know. I think if we're in one model, we got one set of solutions. If we're in another, we have another. And that's why it's tough to answer these questions about development, right? Because we have models which assume that everybody's on just on a gentle hillside. The United States just happens to be a little bit farther up the hillside, right? So how do we help these people up the hillside? This is like Ron said the other night after we talked about competition. You know, that in my neighborhood, you get these people, man, they don't care. They're not on the same slope I'm on. But Lon's talking about whiteness. There are people on different slopes. That's not right. How do we change it? There are nations on different slopes. I don't know. Which, you know, we're not on slopes. We're on islands. How do you get from this island to that island? Okay, so one of my, I won't say that. I win the Nobel Prize if I figure this out, okay? No kidding. I don't know. Maybe I can, maybe I can't. You know, I'm trying. It's that important. How do we get one society from one island to another? We don't know yet. We don't know how to do it. The World Bank and the IMF and the Lutheran World Relief, you can name, and you can pick them from the right side or the left side. They haven't figured out how to do it yet. They say, best we can do is sit here. We can take care of people. We don't know how to fix the chairs yet. Yep.
What I hear you saying is that healthy competition follows order.
Produces order.
And so the question that leads for me is we now have corporations that are bigger than any nation.
Yeah. No, we don't have any corporations bigger than the United States. Not one. In fact, we're the biggest corporation in the world.
Well, okay, but they no longer are bound by the limits of the United States or the order of the United States. They function in a world. Does that mean that we need a world source of order, a world government?
I don't know. I mean, I could imagine it being good. I could imagine that being bad. I think it's really false to say there's corporations bigger than nations. Where do corporations come from? What makes Holden Village a corporation?
Government. That's true.
The state of Washington.
Well, in terms of competition, they're pitting our workers against the workers in China.
That's fine. I know some people really have a problem with that. I have my coffee cup. I wanted to bring it. I left in the dining hall. It's made in China. That's good. You know why? Because I'd rather pay $11.75 for a coffee mug made in China than for $15 for a coffee cup made in Chelan. Actually, at that
more
point...
More choices. I will pay $15 for the coffee cup made in Chelan.
You will, and you'd pay more for one made by firefighters, right?
I certainly
you
would.
You certainly would. He runs a pack for firefighters. That's good. I don't have any problem with that.
I just want, competition is, in our system, is the source of order. Now, is there a causal there? There's a causal the other way too, right? It's endogenous. This is, I forget your name. I shook your hand in the kitchen the other day. Don't you remember?
Yeah.
I tried to get you to smile. You're doing it now. It looks good. Smile. I was trying to put away the pot. Order causes, you got to have order to have competition. Competition sustains order. In the natural state, the Ron Don John world, competition is deadly. It produces disorder. In Iraq, political competition is producing death, not order. Right? It is. We can see it on the news every day. My son's in the army. My son's at Fort Huachuca. Thank goodness he has a hernia. So he can't get through his individual training, because as soon as he gets through his individual training, he's going to get posted to a unit, and they got a 1 in 3 chance every 6 months of getting sent to Iraq, and I don't want my son to die in Iraq. I don't have a problem. I support it. I gave my son. I let him go. Yeah. Those are better choices, Dexter. Oh, they're my choices, not yours. Go. You have my blessing. I'm scared. Do I want competition? Yeah, I want to live in a society in which competition orders society, in which competition keeps corporations honest, right? You can say Microsoft is too big, but you know, 10 years from now, Microsoft could be gone. Red Hat could have wiped Microsoft out. It didn't. You know, and we all think Bill Gates is evil, except we can't figure he's a nice guy. He's giving away $50 billion. He's doing all this stuff. He carpooled with my first wife when they were in high school. You know, he's a guy. Yeah. He grew up in, what?
The story's not over.
The story's not over, right?
And actually, he and Warren Buffett did this piece on that Charlie Rose covered for the Nights, and he said the very same thing that you said. He said, I don't know if I'll be around.
Yeah.
He said, you know, and he was saying the very same thing that you're saying.
In fact, here's the problem with an open access society, and this is a miracle, and you guys are not, many people are not going to like what I'm about to say. Without big corporations, American democracy wouldn't work.
So, I'm interested in the piece that goes, we live in the South Lake Union area,
yeah,
of Seattle, where Paul Allen,
right,
Bill Gates' partner was.
Right.
So what do you do with your $31 billion?
Right.
Do you make a commitment through your foundation to try to eradicate polio, heal diseases, and raise,
right,
the literacy level? Or do you build a private spaceship?
Right. He's doing all those things, right?
No.
Oh, Paul,
you sort of get the choice.
Right.
You get,
choices.
Bill Gates,
right,
who's got a foundation and a commitment to actually do something with his wealth, or you get Paul Allen, who, well, I don't know, music experience and private spaceship.
Right.
Sports teams.
And,
yeah,
yeah, sports teams.
Teams.
And I'm just,
okay,
saying. So I'm
okay.
Here's one of the things that we've held off on all week, and very appropriately, because you're trying to lay out something more systemic than,
right,
is. I'm also interested in those choices. Last night at the forum, you started to play at the level of the chair you're in now.
Right.
And you said it's a lot more interesting to provide an education dollar to a child,
right,
than a healthcare dollar to an 85-year-old.
Right.
And so I'm interested in this point that you keep making over and over,
yeah,
that we need to be aware of and know both of these chairs,
right,
because it seems to me that the chair you're in now has to keep being the chair that informs the value level,
right,
that drives the corporation.
I agree. I agree with you 100%. Is wealth demoralizing? Well, it's the person who's sitting in this chair that figures that out. This chair. The person. The guy.
Doesn't that go back all to the original statement that was made too? Like, it's not that easy. You're coming,
right,
forward with these, you,
yeah,
know, various, well, let's have, you know, three parties, and as a result, there'll be enough competition, or, you know.
Yeah.
But the thing is that, you know, I'm an educator, and I think that to a certain degree, when you're getting down to the nucleus of really trying to be able to make a change, even perhaps on one individual, is for them to be able to realize that they do indeed have the choice of being able to better themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because in many cases, there's the self-image of them saying, it doesn't matter what kind of choices I make, because all the choices will always be made for me. Even in America, they feel that way. And if you're, you know, running in the streets that Ron is running into, they are, all of those guys don't care whether or not there's, you know, they're making money this way or this guy gets killed, because it's always an issue of self-preservation.
Mm-hmm.
And and maybe in essence, if it becomes more of an issue of education and you know, grassroots, you know, building. And I know this isn't.
But, okay, it's not that. I mean, it is that, and it's not that. Okay. I don't mean to stop you, but I want to stop you there because that's really an important point to believe. People believe, right, what they learn and what they're taught. There's two combinations there, right? We have to learn from first our parents, then our teachers and our churches and our communities, because we can't possibly learn enough about the world to navigate it. Remember being scared when you were 17? In me, it came out as being cocky. You know, I didn't want to act scared, so I act cocky. I know what I'm doing. I'm tough. I'm smart. You know, I'm stupid, but you know, everybody looking at me can tell I was stupid. I do that. How do I learn about the world? Okay, now, it can't just be teaching, right? Because it's got to be consistent with a world that's really out there. In the Ron Don John world, and this is really, you know, Rachel, you're talking about this in the Steve Ball thing about Honduras and the people coming in from the community. In a natural state, the reality is that outside of the elite, there are many fewer choices for most people. They do not have choices like we do, okay? Because the system does not give them choices. In fact, if they have choices and they have entry, the system falls apart. So they learn a world in which they don't have choices, and you can't educate them out of that. Right? You can't tell them that the world is not the way you see it. Because they'll die if they start believing that.
It's the same way with caged animals. If you open up the cage, a bird that's used to the safety of that particular cage, they're not going to fly away.
Right, but we should not believe that these chairs exist in those places. We should not believe that a society like Chad has the institutional ability that if just people got the right ideas, their society would start working. Because they don't have the institutions of society to help make that work. And yeah, no, it is a combination of things. And that's why getting from one island to another island is so hard, because you can't just whip change the institution. You got to change the religion. You got to change the way people believe. You got to change the experience they have. You got to change all of that at the same time. Boy, that's a hard. I'm not saying I got a solution to that problem. I'm saying that's the problem. And I agree with Rachel. It's really complicated.
So do we just accept that? I mean, is that just life, that the big fish eat up the little fish?
No. I want to change it. I want to shake up the system, Vernon.
But are the little fish?
I am going to the world big. And I'm bringing them the message that they're doing this wrong. They got to change.
Is there a such thing as just expendable people?
No, there are societies in which people get treated as expendable. I don't think any of it is expendable. Right? But you know societies where that happens.
Your original confession.
Yeah.
At the beginning was that as you follow your call into macro speculation, indeed people become.
The truth, I believe, is the way I said it, but.
Okay, but. and the piece is missing. Not the piece is missing, but the piece of interest to me, I guess, is that. Talking about Luther 2 days ago.
Yeah.
Luther spent so much time trying to articulate these two chairs.
Yeah.
Also articulates for us a different spiritual perspective.
Yeah.
Which he calls, still uses epicotic, at the same time, saint and sinner. And that's not only for us as people bouncing back and forth between the chairs. I mean, you're not a saint in that chair and a sinner in that chair. You're both in both chairs.
Right.
And as you escalate group size, or you know, the size of the dynamic, the third party dynamic.
Yeah.
I think the schism between saint and sinner is driving us absolutely bananas.
Yep.
Are corporations evil? Absolutely to the core.
Right.
Are they helpful in the system? Absolutely to the core. I mean, that's what you're saying, you know?
Yep.
And so the Lutheran ethic is, then we sit in that chair again.
Right.
And we go, what do we do for Chad? And we go, well, we can't do that because that's evil. Right. Or we can't do that, we become a divided community.
I agree.
And I mean, so the trying to figure this out, this crazy making behavior, which drives us to confession, which is a helpful place to have started.
To start, yeah, I'm all screwed up. I'm guilty. You know what's happened to the human race? It's evolving. Okay? It's changing. It changes all the time. Holden Village is different every year.
Yeah.
every week, right? We're trying to figure this out, and sometimes it really causes us a lot of angst.
So Verlaine says, are corporations treating people like expendable? The truth is, absolutely they are. You know, is it the wealth of this country, does whiteness build itself on the backs of black people? Absolutely it does. Is that the way we need to go for greater wealth? You're saying it is, you know, so questions can both be true at one time. You know, I mean.
I just gave you a story in which, you know, corporations are not all evil. In which the presence of those.
I totally agree they're not all evil. Yeah. But are they evil?
No, they're not always.
Yes, well,
they can be. People are evil. Hey, Kate, wait a minute. Wait. Okay. I think the data questions you're asking are absolutely right on the money. Okay? We know we do not live in a world of saints. Luther tells us, the gospel tells us, Paul tells us that this chair is necessary. This law is necessary. And it's not, as you know, I read that thing on vengeance from Luther. That was from Matthew. When Luther talks about obedience to the state, he's talking about vengeance. Is vengeance mine? You know, who should exercise it? There needs to be that law. And we know that somehow that here, and how do we as Christians feel about this? In fact, in that, I think it's Rachel's what I'm trying to say. How should we think about this? Right? And we know it's really, really complicated, and I apologize for making it too simple. Okay? I want to be simple. I'm not acting as a historian here, I'm acting as a theorist. I want to tell a story that I can convey to you and that would be simple. And, you know, it's going to drive us nuts. It does. It does. And the contradictions of what works and doesn't work in our society are the result of the fact that it is not a black and white world. Right? We know that sometimes these corporations are doing bad things. Okay? And we know that sometimes they're doing great things. We know that organization is really important. And so when we look at developed and undeveloped societies, non-developing or first and third world, you know, what do we see? You know, we see different things, and the question is, you know, can we figure out a way to help that? And I, you know, I'm not saying there's a way without angst.
Oh, yeah, well, I have to say the only way is with angst. And the other thing Luther said is fundamentally, that stuff doesn't work. The church needs to get out of the law business. It needs to get out of that solution. It needs to get out of God working that way, because it's not the way that we've been shown works for us. We've got a different calling. And maybe the different calling is to exercise those powers of the church. People are going crazy trying to figure that stuff out.
Yeah.
And so that we are there to hear confessions, absolve people, tell them to go back out, tell them we know we're not perfect. I have a different passion.
Yeah.
I'm not a preacher who decided to go to economics. I'm an economist who decided to go to preaching. So I'm your evil inverse. But if you're going to use Luther's a logos for that, then there's some very interesting things.
Okay. Yeah. We're 5 minutes over. I promise I wouldn't do that. So here's what I think. I think this chair is history. Okay. In Christ comes to conquer history for me. Right. And he does that here for me. Regardless of my history, it's a race. It's not X'd out, it's a race, it's gone. Right? But we live in history. We are compelled to take care of this chair, figure out how to do it better, right? And we need to see with clear eyes here that we're not making this chair better to make us feel more comfortable over here, right? That we want to make this chair work. Not just make us ease our pain. Thank you very much.